Man, that was beautiful. I'm so disappointed that I'm up here now. That was amazing. If you have a Bible, if you'll open it up to the book of Esther, please. We're going to actually finish up our study in the book of Esther tonight. Esther chapter 8. We've been going through looking at this story, this very strange, very unique story in all of the Bible that tells of how God preserved the Israelites during a time of intense persecution, intense anti-Semitism, even though his name isn't mentioned anywhere in the book. God worked through the various events that were unfolding in a couple people's lives, and he worked through them to preserve the nation of Israel. And we've looked at all the various aspects of how God was in the details, and yet the people themselves don't seem to acknowledge God or notice he's even there or at work. As we left off last time, the wicked Haman, who had set up a plan to try to destroy all of the Israelites because he had a feud between himself and Mordecai, which, as we've said numerous times already, that we believe is racially motivated, God worked to where everything got reversed. And we keep pointing out that this was God and his sovereign work going on here to preserve Israel, even though nobody seems to acknowledge that. It worked out to where Esther was able to convince the king not to allow this thing to happen to the Jewish people. She interceded on behalf of the Jewish people. And where we left off last time, the king had reversed everything. All of the plot that Haman had to try to destroy Mordecai got turned back on himself. And so he'd built a gallows 75 feet tall, and we believe that was actually like a pike or a means by which you'd affix a body to it, more like a crucifixion. 75 feet in the air, and that seems like pretty high in the air, but either way, and he had it all set up for Mordecai. But when the events turned around on him, Haman is the one who was actually hanged on it because the king saw his work as treason. You remember, he was pleading for his life before Esther at the banquet there, and he stumbled and fell, and he fell across Esther. And when the king returned and came in the room, Haman is laying across Esther, and he's angry because he sees that as some sort of sexual assault, and so he has Haman hanged. And so that's where we left off last time. Haman has been disposed of. And we start here in chapter 8, first couple verses. It says, on that day then, that very same day, King Ahasuerus gave Queen Esther the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews. And Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had told how he was related to her. So now she's made it clear their relationship. So the king took off his signet ring, which he had taken from Haman, and he gave it to Mordecai, and Esther appointed Mordecai over the house of Haman. Now, I got to tell you guys, if this were a Shakespeare play, this would be high comedy, because this king is a complete bungler. I mean, this king never makes good decisions through this whole book. Each time, I mean, he has just taken the signet ring back from a guy who did terrible things, completely misrepresented him, and no sooner does he get it back from Haman than he turns around and hands it to somebody else whom he doesn't know at all. So clearly, this is portraying him as someone who is blundering his way through this whole thing. I mean, you'd think one blank check mishap would be bad enough, but instead he turns back around and appoints Mordecai to this position of power, though he's untested and unknown to the king. Then we get to verse 3. Now Esther spoke again to the king, fell down at his feet, and implored him with tears to counteract the evil of Haman the Agagite, and the scheme which he had devised against the Jews. And the king held out his golden scepter toward Esther. So Esther arose and stood before the king and said, if it pleases the king, and if I found favor in his sight, and the thing seems to be right for the king, and I'm pleasing in his eyes, let it be written to revoke the letters devised by Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, which he wrote to annihilate the Jews who are in all the king's provinces. For how can I endure to see the evil that will come upon my people? Or how can I endure to see the destruction of my countrymen? Then King Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther and Mordecai the Jew, "Indeed, I've given Esther the house of Haman, and they've hanged him on the gallows because he tried to lay his hand on the Jews. You yourselves write a decree concerning the Jews, as you please, in the king's name, and seal it with the king's signet ring. And whatever is written in the king's name and sealed with the king's signet ring, no one can revoke," even though that's exactly what they're about to do with the earlier law that was just made. Now, the first time that Esther went before the king, remember, her life was in danger. I mean, this was a frightening prospect, and she went very soberly. You know, she got herself dressed very carefully and stood before him, and it was, you know, it was a little more unknown. She was very composed. Now it says she's crying, and she falls down at his feet. So you have a sense from this that she doesn't feel that her life is in danger to the degree that it was before. She feels a little bit more emboldened to go before the king this time. And she's, you know, the first time she went, she was kind of talking on behalf of herself. Now she's going to him on behalf of all the other Jewish people whose lives hang in the balance. And we can assume that this, again, is an uninvited appearance that she's making here, because the king has to hold out his golden scepter again for her to allow her entrance in. So, you know, but again, like I said, this doesn't seem as threatening. She seems to be bold enough to do this. Now, the basis of her request for the king on behalf of the Jewish people is very interesting to me, because she's not making this request based on a moral issue at all. She's not saying to the king, "King, this is terrible, this is genocide, and you can surely see that this is wrong, and we shouldn't be doing this, and you shouldn't be a party to this." No, not at all. What she says in here is that, you know, I couldn't live with the destruction of my people. You know, in other words, she's saying to the king, "I won't be a happy queen anymore if all the Jewish people are killed." Instead of resting this on the moral issue at hand, she's actually falling back into the age-old thing. Hey, look, if mama ain't happy, ain't nobody going to be happy in this house. And so you might want to think about what it is that we want to do here. And so she is appealing. I mean, you know, we could wish it was more noble than this. We could wish that she was, you know, going in there with the word of the Lord to the king. But, you know, she knows basically what she has to do. She knows what it is that's going to motivate him in this. So she's appealing, really, in essence, she's appealing to his own self-interest in this. I won't be happy. And by implication, then, you know, I won't be the happy queen that I was before. As the basis for his reversal of this law, she's appealing to his desire to preserve his own sense of peace. And it works. I mean, you know, he gives Esther what it is that she wants. Esther and Mordecai, he gives free rein to come up with their own law, which is going to, in effect, reverse the former law. And again, I would say that this is, a parody, because the Persian people were proud of the fact that the law was the ultimate rule over their kingdom, that even the king himself had to be subjugated to the law, that the laws weren't going to be overturned when they were made. And we see here how this actually worked, that the laws could not be overturned, even as he says there, if it's sealed with the king's signet ring, then it's irreversible. It can't be overturned unless you can write another law that will actually just in effect undo or work in counteraction to the first law. So we see that even with their noble ideals of being ruled by law and that the law had the supreme power, that too could be easily manipulated to achieve whatever individual's goals were out there. And this, you know, to me is the concept behind this, that to try to show the inconsistency of the Persian rule. Now, you know, it's interesting to me that I came across a commentator who looked at this and actually tried to make a connection between the old covenant law and the new covenant of grace that we have now, saying that basically, in essence, this is what God did. That, you know, that with the old covenant law that said, if a man that sins, the soul that sins shall surely die, that God came in and was able to counteract that law through the law, the perfect law of love. Now, I hope that we're paying attention enough that we would recognize the fallacy of an argument like that, because that is not what happened. God's law is irreversible. That law that said the soul that sins shall surely die never was counteracted, was never remanded. It was never taken out of effect. That law was an eternal law. It stood, it stands to this day. The difference is, it wasn't that God came in and wrote a new law that just did away with his former law. It's that God, taking on flesh, went in and paid the penalty of that law. That law stood and stands, but that law has had its punishment fulfilled. In other words, the penalty for breaking that law has been met, and it was met when Jesus died on the cross for us. So we don't ever want to look at it thinking that God, you know, changed his mind somewhere along the way. He did not. He actually remained true to his own justice, but he himself stood in the pathway of that wrath and took it on himself. That's the great price that was paid. If it was just a matter of God deciding he's going to write another law like the Persians were able to do, and, you know, we'll just write us a new one and it's no big deal, and it minimizes, to embrace a concept like that would actually minimize the sacrifice that Jesus made. Jesus paid everything. Jesus paid for us to be able to receive that mercy and that grace. So either way, just thought I'd throw that in there. And once again, we notice that the king is agreeing to this. He gives a free rein to Esther and Mordecai. He says to write up a law however they please. So once again, this king neatly avoids, he completely abdicates any kind of, at least in this story, any sense of personal responsibility on all of this stuff. Yeah, you write it. I don't care. You know, I got more banquets to go to or whatever. I mean, you know, he's been drinking through the whole thing, so he's probably just, you know, doesn't want to have to try to stop and think for a minute. But either way, so the story goes on. Verse 9. So the king's scribes were called at that time in the third month, which is in the month of Sivan, on the 23rd day, and it was written according to all that Mordecai commanded to the Jews, the satraps, the governors, and the princes of the provinces from India to Ethiopia, 127 provinces in all, to every province in its own script, to every people in their own language, and to the Jews in their own script and language. And he wrote in the name of King Ahasuerus and sealed it with the king's signet ring, and sent letters by couriers on horseback, riding on horses bred from swift steeds. By these letters, the king permitted the Jews who were in every city to gather together and protect their lives, to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the forces of any people or province that would assault them, both little children and women, and to plunder their possessions. On one day in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, on the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, a copy of the document was to be issued as a decree in every province and published for all the people, so that the Jews would be ready on that day to avenge themselves on their enemies. And the couriers who rode on royal horses went out, hastened and pressed on by the king's command, and the decree was issued in Shushan the citadel. Okay, well, all's well that ends well, I guess. I mean, except that this is actually extremely troubling to me as I read it. I mean, I don't know if you noticed this, but this law is not just about self-defense. This law was not just about authorizing the Jewish people to go ahead and protect themselves if they got attacked, to arm themselves in case somebody came in to try to take them out. That would be one thing. If it were just a decree saying that they had a right to protect their property or themselves from any personal harm, but this is more than that. This decree goes beyond defense and it becomes retribution. They avenge themselves against the people that were against them. And the wording of this decree is the same wording as the decree that was made by Haman, including the children and the women. And to me, that's troubling. When I look at that, that doesn't set well with me as I look at this. And it's hard to get a handle on the author's intent on this book. On one hand, you can see why this would be a very happy story for the Jewish people. I mean, because historically, they've been mistreated. Historically, you know, over and over again, they're in a position of being the weak people who are faced by the opposition and oppression of a stronger force. So we can certainly say that it's understandable that this sort of a thing would be a good and a happy ending. But I wonder, to some degree, is this book trying to get a different message across to us, if it's trying to tell us something different. I mean, I'm not sure, but from here on, this book troubles me. And it finds itself completely isolated from the rest of the canon. This book actually stands completely alone. In other words, you'll never find another book in the Bible that references back to this book. We can go to the books that deal with the same time period when we go to Ezra and we go to Nehemiah, and nobody in those books ever mentions any of this stuff that's going on here. And we notice that in this book, it never talks about the stuff that's happening over in Israel or over in Jerusalem. There's a curious something about this book. It stands out like a sore thumb. It's distinct and it's different, and maybe, just maybe, it's supposed to be like that. There may be a message in this that should have been picked up on long ago, even by the Jewish people. I'm not saying that I know that for sure, but I'm saying that there is something that is uneasy about this book, at least for me. We get to verse 15. It says, "And the Jews who were in Shushan gathered together again on the 14th day of the month of Adar and killed 300 men at Shushan, but they didn't lay a hand on the plunder. The remainder of the Jews in the king's provinces gathered together and protected their lives, had rest from their enemies, and killed 75,000 of their enemies, but they didn't lay a hand." Am I in the wrong spot? Oh, man. How long ago did I jump to the wrong spot? How far back did I get off track? Just now? Did I just now do it? I just woke up, I guess. I don't know. So where am I? So I jumped over here. Okay, I know. I see where we are. Okay, right here. Okay, so Mordecai, so forget about what you just heard a little bit ago. So Mordecai went out from the presence of the king in royal apparel of blue and white, and a great crown of gold and a garment of fine linen and purple. And the city of Shushan rejoiced and was glad, and the Jews had light and gladness, joy and honor in every province in the city, wherever the king's command and decree came, the Jews had joy and gladness, a feast and a holiday. Then many of the people of the land became Jews. Well, yeah, because of the fear of the Jews fell upon them. Okay, so Mordecai is honored here. He's, you know, in the empire is made up of a vast group of people, all of whom are under the rule of the party in power, the Persians. So you could kind of imagine why there would have been widespread joy among the people. You know, when you first look at that, you're thinking, why is everybody so stoked about this? Because, I mean, you know, there was great trouble in the city when it was a decree against the Jewish people. Now everybody's kind of happy. Well, I mean, we understand why the Jewish people are happy. Of course they'd be happy. But why is everybody else? And it could very well be that because you've got such a vast array of different nationalities making up the Persian Empire at this time, that there was a sense that, hey, the minorities at this point, the people who represented the minority, were able to get the upper hand and keep from being destroyed like this. So maybe there's hope for all of us. I mean, that's a possibility. I don't know for sure, but I mean, it could be. But this joy that the Jewish people are experiencing at this time because of this reversal of their fortunes is going to be short-lived. King Xerxes is only in power for 20 years total, and so there's only a few years left of this time where they're enjoying his protection, and they know this kind of superiority in the situation. So it's the one and only time within that context over there that they find themselves in a position of power. But for the time being, the Jewish people can call the shots. And of course, that's why, you know, it says there in verse 17, there's just this sudden spike in conversions to Judaism. Everybody's all of a sudden, whoa, you know, of course I'm Jewish. What do you mean? Oi, hey, boy, vey. And, you know, trying to get in on what's happening there. So now chapter 9, verse 1. "Now in the 12th month, that is the month of Adar, on the 13th day, the time came for the king's command and his decree to be executed. On the day that the enemies of the Jews had hoped to overpower them, the opposite occurred, in that the Jews themselves overpowered those who hated them. The Jews gathered together in their cities throughout the provinces of King Ahasuerus to lay hands on those who sought their harm. And no one could withstand them because fear of them fell upon all people. And all the officials of the provinces, the satraps, the governors, and all those doing the king's work helped the Jews because the fear of Mordecai fell upon them. For Mordecai was great in the king's palace, and his fame spread throughout all the provinces. For this man, Mordecai, became increasingly prominent. Thus the Jews defeated all their enemies with the stroke of the sword, with slaughter and destruction, and did what they pleased with those who hated them. And in Shushan, the citadel, the Jews killed and destroyed 500 men. Also in all these other places. And all these other people. Verse 10, and then the sons of Haman, the sons of Hamadatha, the enemy of the Jews, they killed, but they didn't lay a hand on the plunder. Okay, so 9 months pass between chapter 8 and chapter 9. It says, you know, from the third month then to the 12th month. This verse describes the victory of the Jewish people that they had over their foes. And the picture is a troubling picture to me, because the picture that's painted here is of an assembling mob that gathers together and begins to move through the city and round up everybody who ever threatened them or everybody whom they see as a threat to take them out. And the military escorts them through the streets, and the courts don't stop them because Mordecai is a powerful man all of a sudden. Everybody's realizing there's nothing that's going to stop Mordecai. In fact, the fear of Mordecai, an interesting wording in this, has fallen upon all the people, the fear of this man. And so they go through, and in the capital city of Shushan, 500 men, that means 500 men, that doesn't count women and children who may have been disposed of during this time, they're executed. Now, this is a far cry from the description of the battles that we read about in Joshua or in Judges or in Kings. Or Samuel. These are very, very different descriptions here. This actually is not a battle at all as it's described. This is more like reverse oppression. In this roundup, Haman's 10 sons, it says, are numbered in the slaughter. So, of course, you know, obviously, for obvious reasons, they would have taken him out. And the author conspicuously points out here that they didn't take the plunder, which, you know, that does elevate this above an oppression of the strong over the weak. I mean, it's clearly indicating that the motive here is one of survival. They're not after the plunder. They're not out trying to line their pockets. They're clearly trying to preserve themselves in this. But again, it still seems out of sync to me. And you may see it differently, but to me it seems odd in its wording and in the way it's described. Verse 11. On that day, the number of those who were killed in Shushan, the citadel, was brought to the king. And the king said to Queen Esther, the Jews have killed and destroyed 500 men in Shushan, the citadel, and the 10 sons of Haman. What have they done in the rest of the king's provinces? Now, what is your petition? And it'll be granted to you. What's your further request? And it'll be done. And Esther said, if it pleases the king, let it be granted to the Jews who are in Shushan to do again tomorrow, according to today's decree, and let Haman's 10 sons be hanged on the gallows. So the king commanded this to be done. The decree was issued in Shushan, and they hanged Haman's 10 sons. So, the king's proud of the day's work. He gets the body count, and he goes to Esther, and he tells her how many people have been disposed of, and that includes Haman's sons, his 10 sons, you know, so you're not going to have any problem from them anymore. And he can only speculate on how many people have been destroyed in the provinces. You know, all the numbers aren't in yet. So it's, things are really looking up for them. They're on a roll. And since he's on a roll, he's ready to grant any other requests she might have. Got anything else you want to do, queen? Whatever's going to make you happy. And so she has a request. What an interesting request. Can we do this again? Okay, yeah, let's get an extension on the killing spree. And she wants Haman's son's bodies publicly displayed on pikes. I mean, when she's saying hang on the gallows, they're already dead, remember. So the idea is to be able to hang their bodies up for everybody else to see so that the fear of Mordecai, I'm sure, will continue to be reinforced there. You know, you don't know exactly why she's looking for this extension, but she clearly wants this gruesome deed done. Isn't that cute? I mean, she's sweet. I never saw that movie, One Night with the King. Is this part in that movie? Did they put that in there? Anybody see it? But this stuff wasn't in there? No, it was not in there. Why, I wonder. Interesting, huh? So anyway, so let's hang those bodies up and let's, you wonder why an extension in the Capitol? Why one more day of killing in the Capitol? My assumption would be, and others seem to concur with that, I mean, it concurs with other people's assumption, was that this was to allow Mordecai to go through and eradicate anybody who could be a possible threat. Because clearly, after a day like this, you've got the fear of retribution. I mean, somebody's going to have an uncle or a brother or somebody that got killed in the melee, and so they're going to get revenge somehow. So the best thing to do to keep the peace is to go ahead and just take them all out. And you need another day for that. So that's what he wants to be able to do. More than likely, I would assume, that was the meaning behind that. Verse 15. And pretend like you've never heard this before. Verse 15, and the Jews who were in Shushan gathered together again on the 14th day of the month of Adar and killed 300 men in Shushan, but they didn't lay a hand on the plunder. The remainder of the Jews in the king's provinces gathered together and protected their lives and had rest from their enemies and killed 75,000 of their enemies, but they didn't lay a hand on the plunder. This was on the 13th day of the month of Adar. And on the 14th of the month, they rested and made it a day of feasting and gladness. But the Jews who were at Shushan assembled together on the 13th day, as well as on the 14th, and on the 15th day of the month, they rested and they made it a day of feasting and gladness. Therefore, the Jews of the villages who dwelt in the unwalled towns celebrated the 14th day of the month of Adar with gladness and feasting as a holiday and for sending presents to one another. So the final body count of the people outside of the provinces was 75,000 men, women, and children. And, after a hard day of genocide, it's Miller time. And so they have a big feast. Everyone is rejoicing and feasting and having a great day. Well, I mean, everybody, of course, except the people who are burying the dead. In the capital city, they have to wait one more day before they can start their celebration, since they had a lot more to do there. So this explains why the festival of Purim is celebrated on two different days. Depending on whether you're in a walled city or outside of a walled city, you'd celebrate it one day or the other. Or some people will celebrate it on two different days. So we continue reading here. Verse 20, and Mordecai wrote these things and sent letters to all the Jews near and far who were in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, to establish among them that they should celebrate yearly the 14th and 15th days of the month of Adar, as the days on which the Jews had rest from their enemies, as the month which was turned from sorrow to joy for them, and from mourning to a holiday, that they should make them days of feasting and joy, of sending presents to one another and gifts to the poor. So the Jews accepted the custom which they had begun, as Mordecai had written to them, because Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of all the Jews, had plotted against the Jews to annihilate them and cast Pur, that is, the lot, to consume them and destroy them. But when Esther came before the king, he commanded by letter that this wicked plot which Haman had devised against the Jews should return on his own head, and that he and his sons should be hanged on the gallows. So they called these days Purim, after the name Pur. Therefore, because of all the words of this letter, what they had seen according to this matter and what had happened to them, the Jews established and imposed it upon themselves and their descendants and all who would join them, that without fail they should celebrate these 2 days every year according to the written instructions and according to the prescribed time, that these days should be remembered and kept throughout every generation, every family, every province, and every city, that these days of Purim should not fail to be observed among the Jews, and that the memory of them should not perish among their descendants. Then Queen Esther, the daughter of Abihail, with Mordecai the Jew, wrote with full authority to confirm this second letter about Purim. And Mordecai sent letters to all the Jews, to 170 There are 27 provinces of the kingdom of Ahasuerus with words of peace and truth to confirm these days of Purim at their appointed time, as Mordecai the Jew and Queen Esther had prescribed for them, and as they had decreed for themselves and their descendants concerning matters of their fasting and lamenting. So the decree of Esther confirmed these matters of Purim, and it was written in the book. So this is the institution of the festival of Purim. And that's it's a festival among the Jewish people that is celebrated from that time to this very day. It's still a very prominent festival. And there's a few things that we want to take note about this festival. And again, I want to be careful how we walk through this because, you know, obviously I've got a specific opinion about this, and clearly that's coming across as I'm talking about it. So I want you to understand this is my opinion coming across on these things. But I don't want it to come across as though this is being anti-Semitic on my part, because I realize that, you know, that could be misconstrued. You know, if I don't necessarily enjoy the premise of this, it doesn't necessarily, you know, I'm not trying to indict all people because of that. It's just some things to look at as we consider this. The first thing that I want to point out is that, as we've seen with everything else in this book, God is never mentioned, and God doesn't establish this feast. So it's absolutely distinct from the festival days and the feast days that God instituted in the Old Testament covenant that he made through Moses. The author plainly tells us that they imposed it on themselves. Verse 27, it says it, therefore, that, you know, they imposed this on themselves. Secondly, God's not mentioned as the deliverer, and nor is the fear of God the final result of this thing. But in reality, we're pointed back over and over again to Mordecai and to Esther, and the fear of Mordecai is, by and large, what's promoted in this book. He becomes a man of great power, of prominent position and power within the kingdom of Persia. His name even gets recorded in, well, we'll see that a little later on, but his name will get recorded in the books of the kings of Persia. So this is not a day that necessarily commemorates God, although, you know, pious Jewish people will point to God's deliverance in this. So I'm not negating that, you know, and obviously we saw that God was working in the background of this to preserve the Jewish people. But I don't know so much about the final events here, the final outcome of this. We look at the festival of Purim itself. And I don't know, how many of you are familiar with the festival of Purim? It's basically the Israeli equivalent of Mardi Gras. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but are you familiar with Mardi Gras? Everybody pretty much, you know, you understand what that is. I mean, it's a time when there's a lot of feasting, there's a lot of drinking associated with it. In fact, the old writings, the ancient writings that go back to this, when they were putting together how this should be celebrated and observed, you know, there's always plays associated with it. People bring noisemakers, and whenever the story's told and Haman's name is mentioned, everybody, you know, twirls their noisemakers and boos and hisses and stuff like that. And one of the commands by one of the rabbis said that on Purim, you are supposed to drink until you can't distinguish the difference between blessed be Mordecai and cursed be Haman. And so, you know, the idea is you're supposed to get lit pretty well during this. Now, obviously, modern sensibilities are taken into account, and so many rabbis will suggest that if you're in AA, this is not a good idea, or things like, if you're going to be driving home, not a good idea. If you're pregnant, not a good idea. So, you know, they'll put qualifiers on the whole thing. But by and large, when you look at the celebration of this, it is associated with quite a bit of alcohol consumption. And that was one of the theories that's promoted among the Jewish people as to why God's name isn't mentioned in it, because since it's associated with so much drinking, they were worried that they think that possibly some of the scribes later on were worried that in the midst of all this drunkenness, if somebody were to mention God's name in a way that was in vain, that it could be disastrous. So the best course of action was to take God's name. I don't agree with that. I don't think that's really what happened, but I'm just saying that's one of the theories that's promoted among the people. It's an interesting celebration. Many rabbis to this very day believe that Purim is one celebration that will take place even after the Messianic age is inaugurated, which they're still waiting for, which is exactly what they believed even in the time of Jesus, which is interesting to me that Jesus never makes one mention of it. In fact, Jesus disregards it altogether. In fact, you don't find a shred of what's represented in Esther represented anywhere in the New Testament. So it's a curious thing to me. Like I said, it stands out as an oddity in the midst of all of these writings from the Old Covenant. And I'll get to my take on this here in a minute, but let's read chapter 10. There's only three verses in it. And King Ahasuerus imposed tribute on the land and on the islands of the sea. Now all the acts of his power and his might and the account of the greatness of Mordecai, to which the king advanced him, are they not written in the book of the chronicles of the kings of Media and Persia? For Mordecai the Jew was second to King Ahasuerus and was great among the Jews and well received by the multitude of his brethren, seeking the good of his people and speaking peace to all his countrymen. Now, Mordecai obviously was great in the sight of all men. In fact, he was promoted to a great position of power. And in this promotion, there's no mention of God. There's no mention even of God promoting him to this place or of God working through him in the process of this. But he does what he can to promote peace among people. And as I was reading that, I was contemplating that, I've been thinking about this a lot, I started to wonder if maybe that also isn't the message of Esther. Now, when we look at this, we're not looking at a clash of empires like we normally see. We're not looking at a clash between the kingdom of God and the kingdoms of this earth or the empire of man. But what we're looking at, actually, in the book of Esther, even though God is at work doing what he does to preserve his people, we're looking at an assimilation by the kingdom of men. Mordecai, his fame goes down in the books of the chronicles of the kings of Persia. He finds his power base and operates out of a power base that was designed as part of the earthly kingdom. All the while, back in Jerusalem, back in Israel, the faithful have returned and are reestablishing, rebuilding the walls of the sacred city, rebuilding the temple that God had established for the Jewish people. To me, I mean, if we look at this, if the idea were, you know, if the idea behind Purim is to celebrate God's deliverance and the establishment of peace and the reversal of the oppression back on the oppressors, it only lasted for such a short time. And we know from history, it happens to the Jewish people again and again and again and again. There's nothing lasting in this peace that was derived through the operation of the kingdoms of men. The using the tools of empire earth didn't provide any kind of lasting solution for the Jewish people. It was a temporary reversal of fortunes ultimately would be coming back on them. It was doomed to failure at the outset. And I wonder if that's part of the message that we're supposed to read into this, because is it possible, and I'm just proposing this, and you think this through on your own, but is it possible that what we're seeing here are the actual seeds for the rejection of Jesus when he arrives? Because here, through their own ingenuity and through their own plans and purposes, even though, as I say, I believe God was working in it all, but by and large, we don't see them calling out to God. We see them using the machinations of empire earth to achieve their stated goals and exact their own vengeance. So that by the time that the first century rolled around, they were looking for a Messiah who was going to promote a kingdom of this earth, promote a kingdom here on this earth that operated the way the kingdoms of this earth operated. And when Jesus showed up, he showed up with the kingdom of God. And it did not move or operate or do things the way the kingdoms of this earth do things. And because they were looking for something, because they'd been so conditioned to believe that the kingdoms of this earth were the means by which they were going to achieve their goals, they couldn't see Jesus when he stood in front of them. I don't know. I don't know that for sure. But I'm saying it's a possibility. It's all of these events here, especially at the end of this book, are in such stark contrast to the events and the sayings and the attitudes that we're going to see represented in Ezra and Nehemiah, that I think it's stuff that we've got to ponder. I think it's important that we not read into this book a spirituality or an elevated sense of godliness that the text itself doesn't provide us. I think we need to look at this book and carefully consider what the message of it is. If the message is that the kingdoms of this earth are not the means by which we're going to ever know lasting peace, well, then that makes sense to me. And I think there's a great lesson in that for all of us, and especially as people who live here in the United States, because if there's one thing that the church has been guilty of, especially recently, especially within my lifetime, and that is of trying to be Esther and Mordecai, of trying to get in and manipulate the political system as a means of achieving the goals that we have set out in front of us, instead of remembering that this is a clash of empires. Empire Earth will do what Empire Earth will do, but we're called to represent a different kingdom, a kingdom that has a vastly different order from this world, a kingdom that's represented by love, a kingdom that's represented by sacrifice. And it's something for us to remember, something for us to think about at least and contemplate. Even if you don't agree with me on this, something to consider as we mull over the implications of this very curious book of Esther. So Father, I just pray, Lord, that you inspire us by your Spirit. Enable us to think, Lord God. We don't ever want to find ourselves flowing along with accepted perspectives without taking the time to look at things, to examine things, and possibly be challenged by your Spirit to see something that we hadn't seen before. In all of these things, Father, we thank you that you are faithful. You're faithful to deliver. You're faithful to preserve. We thank you for all the ways in which you've done that in our lives and we haven't recognized it. We thank you for all those times that we've not been aware of how you've preserved us and kept us on track. Now, Father, I pray that above all these things, we take away from this the knowledge that your kingdom is so much greater, so much more important than all of the kingdoms of this earth combined. And I pray, Father, that we can follow Jesus' example. When the enemy came and offered him the kingdoms of this world, his response was that we bow the knee to the Father. We bow the knee to God and to God alone. We stand or fall before our own master. And our own master is Christ. So I pray, Father, that we keep our perspectives clear and our motives genuine and that we represent your kingdom well. I pray this, Lord, in Jesus' name. Amen. All right.